and put it on the patient's shoulder. And look there, he's had a blade of some kind right through the trapezius muscle.
A bayonet, put in the patient helpfully.
A bayonet, I exclaimed. And why didn't you tell me? He shrugged and stopped short with a mild grunt of pain.
I felt it go in, but I couldn't tell how bad it was. It didn't hurt that much.
Is it hurting now?
It is,
he said shortly.
Good,
I said, completely provoked. You deserve it. Maybe that will teach you to go haring round the countryside, kidnapping young women and killing people and... I felt myself ridiculously close to tears and stopped, fighting for control.
Dougal was growing impatient with this conversation. Well, can you keep one foot on either side of the horse, man?
He can't go anywhere, I protested indignantly. He ought to be in hospital. Certainly he can't. My protests, as usual, went completely ignored.
Can ye ride? Dougal repeated.
Aye, if you'll take the lassie off my chest and fetch me a clean shirt.
Chapter 4. I come to the castle. The rest of the journey passed uneventfully, if you consider it uneventful to ride 15 miles on horseback through rough country at night, frequently without benefit of roads, in company with kilted men armed to the teeth and sharing a horse with a wounded man. At least we weren't set upon by highwaymen. We encountered no wild beasts, and it didn't rain. By the standards I was becoming used to, it was quite dull. Dawn was coming up in streaks and slashes over the foggy moor. Our destination loomed ahead, a huge bulk of dark stone outlined by the grey light. The surroundings were no longer quiet and deserted. There was a trickle of rudely dressed people heading toward the castle. They moved to the side of the narrow road to let the horses trot past, gawking at what they plainly thought my outlandish garb. Not surprisingly, it was misting heavily, but there was enough light to show a stone bridge arching over a small stream that ran past the front of the castle down to a dully gleaming loch a quarter mile away. The castle itself was blunt and solid, no fanciful turrets or toothed battlements. This was more like an enormous fortified house, with thick stone walls and high slitted windows. A number of chimney pots smoked over the slick tiles of the roof, adding to the general impression of greyness. The gated entrance of the castle was wide enough to accommodate 2 wagons side by side. I say this without fear of contradiction, because it was doing exactly that as we crossed the bridge. One ox-drawn wagon was loaded with barrels, the other with hay. Our little cavalcade huddled on the bridge, waiting impatiently for the wagons to complete their laborious entry. I risked a question as the horses picked their way over the slippery stones of the wet courtyard. I hadn't spoken to my escort since hastily redressing his shoulder by the roadside. He had been silent too, aside from an occasional grunt of discomfort when a misstep by the horse jolted him. "Where are we?" I croaked, my voice hoarse from cold and disuse.
"The Keep of Leoch," he answered shortly.
Castle Leoch. Well, at least now I knew where I was. When I had known it, Castle Leoch was a picturesque ruin some 30 miles north of Bagrennan. It was considerably more picturesque now, what with the pigs rooting under the walls of the keep and the pervasive smell of raw sewage. I was beginning to accept the impossible idea that I was, most likely, somewhere in the 18th century. I was sure that such filth and chaos existed nowhere in the Scotland of 1945, bomb craters or no. And we were definitely in Scotland. The accents of the people in the courtyard left no doubt of that.
"Hi, Dougal!"
shouted a tattered hostler, running up to grab the halter of the lead horse.
"You're early, man. We hadn't thought to see you before the gathering."
The leader of our little group swung down from the saddle, leaving the reins to the grubby youth.
"Aye. Well, we've had some luck, both good and bad. I'm off to see my brother. Will you summon Mrs. Fitz to feed the lads? They'll need their breakfasts and their beds."
He He beckoned Murta and Rupert down to accompany him, and together they disappeared under a pointed archway. The rest of us dismounted and stood steaming in the wet courtyard for another 10 minutes before Mrs. Fitz, whoever she might be, consented to show herself. A cluster of curious children gathered around us, speculating on my possible origins and function. The bolder ones had just begun to get up enough courage to pluck up my skirt when a large, stout lady in dark brown linen and homespun bustled out and shooed them away.
"Willie, my dear," she cried, "how good to see ye. And Neddy!"
She gave the small, balding man a hearty buss of welcome that nearly knocked him over.
"You'll be needing breakfast, I reckon. Plenty in the kitchen. Do ye go and feed yourselves?"
Turning to me and Jamie, she started back as though bitten by a snake. She looked open-mouthed at me, and then turned to Jamie for an explanation of this apparition.
"Claire," he said, with a brief tilt of his head toward me.
"And Mistress Fitzgibbons," he added, with a tilt the other way. "Murta found her yesterday, and Dougal said we must bring her along with us," he added, making it clear it was no good blaming him.
Mistress Fitzgibbons closed her mouth and looked me up and down with an air of shrewd evaluation. Apparently she decided that I looked harmless enough, despite my odd and scandalous appearance, for she smiled, kindly, despite several missing teeth, and took me by the arm.
"Well then, Claire, welcome to ye. Come with me and we shall find ye something a bit more..."
She looked over my short skirt and inadequate shoes, shaking her head. She was leading me firmly away when I remembered my patient. "Oh, wait, please. I forgot Jamie." Mistress Fitzgibbons was surprised.
"Why, Jamie can fend for himself. He knows where to get food, and someone will find him a bed."
"But he's hurt. He was shot yesterday and stabbed last night. I bandaged the wound for riding, but I didn't have time to clean or dress it properly. I must care for it now, before it gets infected."
"Infected?"
"Yes. That is, I mean, inflamed, you know, with pus and swelling and fever."
"Oh, I know what you mean. But do you mean to say as you know what to do for that? Are you a charmer, then? A beaten?"
"Something like that." I had no notion what a beaten might be, nor any wish to go into my medical qualifications, standing out in the chilly drizzle that had set in. Mistress Fitzgibbons seemed of a light mind, for she called back Jamie, who was making off in the opposite direction, and taking him also by an arm, towed us both into the castle. After a long trip through cold, narrow corridors, dimly lit by slitted windows, we came to a fairly large room, furnished with a bed, a couple of stools, and, most importantly, a fire. I ignored my patient temporarily in favour of thawing my hands. Mistress Fitzgibbons, presumably immune to cold, sat Jamie on a stool by the fire, and gently got the remains of his tattered shirt off, replacing it with a warm quilt from the bed. She clucked at the shoulder, which was bruised and swollen, and poked at my clumsy dressing. I turned from the fire. "I think it will need to be soaked off, and then the wound cleansed with a solution for preventing fevers." Mistress Fitzgibbons would have made an admirable nurse.
"What will you be needing?" she asked simply.
I thought hard. What in the name of God had people used for preventing infection before the advent of antibiotics? And of those limited compounds which might be available to me in a primitive Scottish castle just after dawn? "Garlic," I said in triumph. "Garlic, and if you have it, witch hazel. Also, I'll need several clean rags and a kettle of water for boiling."
"Aye, well, I think we can manage that. Perhaps a bit of comfrey as well. What about a bit of boneset tea or chamomile? Clad looks as though it's been a long night."
The young man was, in fact, swaying with weariness, too tired to protest our discussing him as though he were an inanimate object. Mrs. Fitzgibbons was soon back, with an apron full of garlic bulbs, gauze bags of dried herbs, and torn strips of old linen. A small black iron kettle hung from one meaty arm, and she held a large demijohn of water as though it were so much goose down.
"Now then, my dear, what would you have me do?" she said cheerfully.
I set her to boiling water and peeling the cloves of garlic while I inspected the contents of the herb packets. There was the witch hazel I had asked for, boneset and comfrey for tea, and something I tentatively identified as cherry bark. "Painkiller," I muttered happily, recollecting Mr. Crook explaining the uses of the barks and herbs we found.
"Good. We'd need that."
I threw several cloves of peeled garlic into the boiling water with some of the witch hazel, then added the cloth strips to the mixture. The boneset, comfrey, and cherry bark were steeping in a small pan of hot water set by the fire. The preparations had steadied me a bit. If I didn't know for certain where I was or why I was there, at least I knew what to do for the next quarter of an hour.
"Thank you. Mrs. Fitzgibbons," I said respectfully, "I can manage now if you have things to do."
The giant dame laughed, breasts heaving.
"Ah, lass, there aye be things for me to do. I'll send a bit of broth up for you. Do you call out if you need anything else?"
She waddled to the door with surprising speed and disappeared on her rounds. I pulled the bandages off as carefully as I could. Still, the rayon pads stuck to the flesh, coming away with a soft crackling of dried blood. Droplets of fresh blood oozed around the edges of the wound, and I apologized for hurting him, though he hadn't moved or made a sound. He smiled slightly, with a hint perhaps of flirtation.
"No worry, lass. I've been hurt much worse, and by people much less pretty."
He bent forward for me to wash the wound with the boiled garlic decoction, and the quilt slipped from his shoulder. I saw at once that, whether meant as a compliment or not, his remark was a statement of plain fact. He had been hurt much worse. His upper back was covered with a crisscross of faded white lines. He had been savagely flogged, and more than once. There were small lines of silvery scar tissue in some spots, where the welts had crossed, and irregular patches where several blows had struck the same spot, flaying off skin and gouging the muscle beneath. I had, of course, seen a great variety of wounds and injuries doing combat nursing, but there was something about these scars that seemed shockingly brutal. I must have drawn in my breath at the sight, for he turned his head and caught me staring. He shrugged his good shoulder.
"Lobster backs. Flogged me twice in the space of a week. They'd have done it twice the same day, I expect, were they not afraid of killing me. No joy in flogging a dead man."
I tried to keep my voice steady while I sponged. "I shouldn't think anyone would do such a thing for joy."
"No. You should have seen him."
"Who?"
"The redcoat captain that skinned my back for me. If he was not precisely joyous, he was at least very pleased with himself." "More nor I was," he added wryly. "Randall was the name."
"Randall?" I couldn't keep the shock from my voice. Cold blue eyes fixed on mine.
"You're familiar with the man?"
The voice was suddenly suspicious. "No, no. I used to know a family of that name a long time ago. In my nervousness, I dropped the sponge cloth. "Drat! Now that will have to be boiled again." I scooped it off the floor and bustled to the fireplace, trying to hide my confusion in busyness. Could this Captain Randall possibly be Frank's ancestor, the soldier with a sterling record, gallant on the field of battle, recipient of commendations from dukes? And if so, could someone related to my sweet, gentle Frank possibly be capable of inflicting the horrifying marks on this lad's back? I busied myself at the fire, dropping in a few more handfuls of witch hazel and garlic, setting more cloths to soak. When I thought I could control my voice and face, I came back to Jamie, sponge in hand.
"Why were you flogged?" I asked abruptly.
It was hardly tactful, but I badly wanted to know, and was too tired to phrase it more gently. He sighed, moving his shoulder uneasily under my ministrations. He was tired too. and I was undoubtedly hurting him, gentle as I tried to be.
The first time was escape, and the second was theft. Or at least that's what the charge sheet read.
What were you escaping from?
The English, he said, with an ironic lift of his brow. If you mean where?
Fort William.
I gathered it was the English, I said, matching the dryness of his tone.
What were you doing in Fort William in the first place? He rubbed his brow with his free hand.
Oh, that. I think that was obstruction.
Obstruction, escape, and theft. You sound a right dangerous character, I said lightly, hoping to distract him from what I was doing. It worked at least slightly. One corner of the wide mouth turned up, and one dark blue eye glinted back over his shoulder at me.
Ooh, I am that, he said. I wonder you think yourself safe in the same room with me. And you an English lassie.
Well, you look harmless enough at the moment. This was entirely untrue. Shirtless, scarred and blood-smeared, with stubbled cheeks and reddened eyelids from the long night ride, he looked thoroughly disreputable. And tired or not, he looked entirely capable of further mayhem should the need arise. He laughed, a surprisingly deep, infectious sound.
Harmless as a setting dove, he agreed. I'm too hungry to be a threat to anything but breakfast. Let a stray bannock come within reach, though, and I'll no answer for the consequences. Oh!
Sorry, I muttered. The stab wound's deep and it's dirty.
That's all right.
But he had gone pale beneath the coppery stubble of his beard. I tried to lead him back into conversation. What exactly is obstruction? I asked casually. I must say it doesn't sound a major crime. He took a deep breath, fixing his eyes resolutely on the carved bedpost as I swabbed deeper.
Ah, well, I suppose it's whatever the English say it is. In my case, it meant defending my family and my property and getting myself half-killed in the process.
He pressed his lips together as if to say no more, but after a moment went on, as though seeking to focus his attention on anything other than his shoulder.
It was near to 4 years ago. There was a levy put on the manors near Fort William. Food for the garrison, horses for transport and such like. I wouldn't say many liked it, but most would yield what they had to. Small parties of soldiers would go round with an officer and a wagon or two, collecting the bits of food and things. And one day in October, yon Captain Randall came along to...
He caught himself quickly with a glance at me. To our place. I nodded encouragingly, eyes on my work.
We'd thought they'd not come so far. The place is a good distance from the fort and not easy to get to. But they did.
He closed his eyes briefly.
My father was away, gone to a funeral at the next farm. And I was up in the fields with most of the men, for it was close to harvest and a lot to be done. So my sister was alone in the house, except for two or three of the women servants, and they all rushed upstairs to hide their heads under the bedclothes when they saw the red coats. Thought the soldiers were sent by the devil. And I'll no just say they were wrong.
I laid down my cloth. The nasty part was done. Now all we needed was a poultice of some kind. Lacking iodine or penicillin, it was the best I could do for infection, and a good tight dressing. Eyes still closed, the young man didn't appear to notice.
I came down toward the house from behind, meaning to fetch a piece of harness from the barn, and heard the shouting and my sister screaming inside the house.
Oh? I tried to make my voice as quiet and unintrusive as I could. I wanted very much to know about this Captain Randall. So far, this story had done little to dispel my original impression of him.
I went in through the kitchen and found two of them rifling the pantry, stuffing their sacks with flour and bacon. I punched one of them in the head and threw the other out the window, sack and all. Then I burst into the parlour, where I found two of the redcoats with my sister Jenny. Her dress was torn a bit, and one of them had a scratched face.
He opened his eyes and smiled a bit grimly.
I didn't stop to ask questions.
We were going round and about, and I wasn't a-doing too poorly, for all there were two of them, when Randall came in.
Randall had stopped the fight by the simple expedient of holding a pistol to Jenny's head. Forced to surrender, Jamie had quickly been seized and bound by the two soldiers. Randall had smiled charmingly at his captive and said,
"Well, well, two spitfire scratch cats here, have we? A taste of hard labour will cure your temper, I trow. And if it doesn't, well, there's another cat you'll meet, name of Nine Tails. But there's other cures for other cats, aren't there, my sweet pussy?"
Jamie stopped for a moment, jaw working. He was holding Jenny's arm behind her back, but he let it go then to bring his hand round and put it down her dress, round her breast, like. Remembering the scene, he smiled unexpectedly.
"So," he resumed, "Jenny stamped down on his foot and gave him her elbow deep in the belly. And as he was bent over, choking, she whirled around and gave him a good root in the stones with her knee."
He snorted briefly with amusement.
"Well, at that he dropped the pistol and she went for it. But one of the dragoons holding me got to it first."
I had finished the bandaging and stood quiet behind him, a hand resting on his good shoulder. It seemed important he should tell me everything, but I was afraid he would stop if he were reminded of my presence.
When he got back enough breath to talk with, Randall had his men haul us both outside. They stripped off my shirt and bound me to the wagon tongue, and Randall beat me across the back with the flat of his sabre. He was in a black fury, but a wee bit worse for wear, you might say. It stung me a bit, but he couldn't keep it up for long.
The brief spurt of amusement had vanished now, and the shoulder under my hand was hard with tension.
When he stopped, he turned to Jenny. One of the dragoons had hold of her, and asked her, did she want to see more, or would she rather go into the house with him and offer him better entertainment?
The shoulder twitched uneasily.
I couldn't move much, but I shouted to her that I wasn't hurt. And I wasn't, too much, and she was not to go with him, not if they cut my throat before her eyes. They were holding her behind me so I couldn't see, but from the sound of it, she spat in his face. She must have done, because next thing I knew, he'd grabbed a handful of my hair, pulled my head back, and set his knife against my throat. "I've a mind to take you at your suggestion," Randall had said through his teeth,
and dug the point just beneath the skin, far enough to draw blood.
"I could see the dagger close to my face," Jamie said, "and the pattern of spots my blood was making in the dust under the wagon."
His tone was almost dreamy, and I realised that from fatigue and pain, he had lapsed into something like a hypnotic state. He might not even remember that I was there.
I made to call out to my sister, to tell her that I'd much preferred to die than have her dishonour herself with such scum. Randall took the dagger from my throat, though, and thrust the blade betwixt my teeth so I couldn't call out.
He rubbed at his mouth, as though still tasting bitter steel. He stopped talking, staring straight ahead. But what happened then? I shouldn't have spoken, but I had to know. He shook himself, like a man rousing from sleep, and rubbed a large hand tiredly across the back of his neck.
"She went with him," he said abruptly. "She thought he would kill me, and perhaps she was right. After that, I dinna ken what happened. One of the dragoons hit me in the head with the stock of his musket. When I woke, I was trussed up in the wagon with the chickens jolting down the road toward Fort William."
"I see," I said quietly. "I'm sorry. It must have been terrible for you." He smiled suddenly, the haze of fatigue gone.
"Oh, aye. Chickens are very poor company, especially on a long journey."
Realising that the dressing was completed, he hunched the shoulder experimentally, wincing as he did so. "Don't do that," I said in alarm. "You really mustn't move it." In fact, I glanced at the table to be sure there were some strips of dry fabric left. "I'm going to strap that arm to your side. Hold still." He didn't speak further, but relaxed a bit under my hands when he realised that it wasn't going to hurt. I felt an odd sense of intimacy with this young Scottish stranger, due in part, I thought, to the dreadful story he had just told me, and in part to our long ride through the dark, pressed together in drowsy silence. I hadn't slept with many men, other than my husband, but I had noticed before that to sleep, actually sleep with someone, did give this sense of intimacy, as though your dreams had flowed out of you to mingle with his and fold you both in a blanket of unconscious knowing. A throwback of some kind, I thought. In older, more primitive times, like these, asked another part of my mind, it was an act of trust to sleep in the presence of another person. If the trust was mutual, simple sleep could bring you closer together than the joining of bodies. The strapping finished, I helped him on with a rough linen shirt, easing it over the bad shoulder. He stood up to tuck it one-handed into his kilt and smiled down at me.
I thank you, Claire. You've a good touch.
His hand reached out as though to touch my face, but he seemed to think better of it. The hand wavered and dropped to his side. Apparently he had felt that odd surge of intimacy too. I looked hastily away, flipping a hand in a think-nothing-of-it gesture. My gaze travelled around the room, taking in the smoke-blackened fireplace, the narrow unglazed windows, and the solid oak furnishings. No electrical fittings, no carpeting, no shiny brass knobs on the bedstead. It looked, in fact, like an 18th-century castle. But what about Frank? The man I had met in the wood looked disturbingly like him, but Jamie's description of Captain Randall was completely foreign to everything I knew about my gentle, peace-loving husband. But then, if it were true, and I was beginning to admit even to myself that it might be, then he could, in fact, be almost anything. A man I knew only from a genealogical chart was not necessarily bound to resemble his descendants in conduct. But it was Frank himself I was concerned with at the moment. If I was, in fact, in the 18th century, where was he? What would he do when I failed to return to Mrs. Baird's? Would I ever see him again? Thinking about Frank was the last straw. Since the moment I stepped into the rock and ordinary life ceased to exist, I had been assaulted, threatened, kidnapped, and jostled. I hadn't eaten or slept properly for more than 24 hours. I tried to control myself, but my lip wobbled and my eyes filled in spite of myself. I turned to the fire to hide my face, but too late. Jamie took my hand, asking in a gentle voice what was wrong. The firelight glinted on my gold wedding band, and I began to sniffle in earnest. Oh, I'll be all right. It's all right, really. It's just my husband. I don't...
Ah, lass, are you widowed, then?
His voice was so full of sympathetic concern that I lost control entirely. No. Yes. I mean, I don't... Yes. I suppose I am. Overcome with emotion and tiredness, I collapsed against him, sobbing hysterically. The lad had nice feelings. Instead of calling for help or retreating in confusion, he sat down, gathered me firmly onto his lap with his good arm, and sat rocking me gently, muttering soft Gaelic in my ear, and smoothing my hair with one hand. I wept bitterly, surrendering momentarily to my fear and heartbroken confusion, but slowly I began to quiet a bit as Jamie stroked my neck and back, offering me the comfort of his broad, warm chest. My sobs lessened, and I began to calm myself, leaning tiredly into the curve of his shoulder. No wonder he was so good with horses, I thought blearily, feeling his fingers rubbing gently behind my ears, listening to the soothing, incomprehensible speech. If I were a horse, I'd let him ride me anywhere. This absurd thought coincided, unfortunately, with my dawning realization that the young man was not completely exhausted after all. In fact, it was becoming embarrassingly obvious to both of us.
I coughed and cleared my throat, wiping my eyes with my sleeve as I slid off his lap. I'm so sorry. That is, I mean, thank you for... But I was babbling, backing away from him with my face flaming. He was a bit flushed too, but not disconcerted. He reached for my hand and pulled me back. Careful not to touch me otherwise, he put a hand under my chin and forced my head up to face him.
"You need not be scared of me," he said softly, "nor of anyone here so long as I'm with you."
He let go and turned to the fire.
"You need something hot, lass," he said matter-of-factly, "and a bit to eat as well. Something in your belly will help more than anything."
I laughed shakily at his attempts to pour broth one-handed and went to help. He was right. Food did help. We sipped broth and ate bread in a companionable silence, sharing the growing comfort of warmth and fullness. Finally, he stood up, picking up the fallen quilt from the floor. He dropped it back on the bed and motioned me toward it.
"Do you sleep a bit, Claire? You're worn out, and likely someone will want to talk with you before too long."
This was a sinister reminder of my precarious position, but I was too exhausted to care much. I uttered no more than a pro forma protest at taking the bed. I had never seen anything so enticing. Jamie assured me he could find a bed elsewhere. I fell headfirst into the pile of quilts and was asleep before he reached the door. Chapter 5. The Mackenzie. I woke in a state of complete confusion. I vaguely remembered that something was very wrong, but couldn't remember what. In fact, I'd been sleeping so soundly that I couldn't remember for a moment who I was, much less where. I was warm, and the surrounding room was piercingly cold. I tried to burrow back into my cocoon of quilts, but the voice that had wakened me was still nagging.
"Come then, lass, come now, you must get up."
The voice was deep and genially hectoring, like the barking of a sheepdog. I pried one reluctant eye open far enough to see the mountain of brown homespun. Mistress Fitzgibbons. The sight of her shocked me back to full consciousness, and memory returned. It was still true, then. Wrapping a blanket about me against the chill, I staggered out of bed and headed for the fire as fast as possible. Mistress Fitzgibbons had a cup of hot broth waiting. I sipped it, feeling like the survivor of some major bombing raid, as she laid out a pile of garments on the bed. There was a long, yellowish linen chemise with a thin edging of lace, a petticoat of fine cotton, two overskirts in shades of brown, and a pale lemon-yellow bodice. Brown striped stockings of wool and a pair of yellow slippers completed the ensemble. Brooking no protests, the dame bustled me out of my inadequate garments and oversaw my dressing from the skin out. She stood back, surveying her handiwork with satisfaction.
"The yellow suits you, lass, I thought it would. Goes well with that brown hair and it brings out the gold in your eyes. Stay, though, you'll need a wee bit of ribbon."
Turning out a pocket like a gunny sack, she produced a handful of ribbons and bits of jewellery. Too stunned to resist, I allowed her to dress my hair, tying back the side locks with primrose ribbon, clucking over the unfeminine unbecomingness of my shoulder-length bob.
"Goodness me, dear, whatever were you thinking to cut your hair so short? Were you in disguise, like? I've heard of some lasses doing so, to hide their sex when travelling. Seems to be safe from the dratted redcoats. 'Tis a fine day, says I, when ladies cannot travel the roads in safety."
She ran on, patting me here and there, tucking in a curl or arranging a fold. Finally, I was arrayed to her satisfaction.
"Well, now, that's very good. Now you've just time for a wee bite. Then I must take you to himself."
"Himself?" I said. I didn't care for the sound of this. Whoever himself was, he was likely to ask difficult questions.
"Why, the Mackenzie, to be sure. Whoever else?"
Who else, indeed? Castle Leoch, I dimly recalled, was in the middle of the Clan Mackenzie lands. Plainly, the clan chieftain was still the Mackenzie. I began to understand why our little band of horsemen had ridden through the night to reach the castle. This would be a place of impregnable safety to men pursued by the crownsmen. No English officer with a grain of sense would lead his men so deeply into the clan lands. To do so was to risk death by ambush at the first clump of trees. And only a good-sized army would come as far as the castle gates. I was trying to remember whether, in fact, the English army ever had come so far, when I suddenly realised that the eventual fate of the castle was much less relevant than my immediate future. I had no appetite for the bannocks and porridge that Mrs. Fitzgibbons had brought for my breakfast, but crumbled a bit and pretended to eat, in order to gain some time for thought. By the time Mrs. Fitz came back to conduct me to the Mackenzie, I had cobbled together a rough plan. The Laird received me in a room at the top of a flight of stone steps. It was a tower room, round and rich with paintings and tapestries hung against the sloping walls. While the rest of the castle seemed comfortable enough, if somewhat bare, this room was luxuriously crowded, crammed with furniture, bristling with ornaments, and warmly lit by fire and candle against the drizzle of the day outside. While the outer walls of the castle had only the high-slit windows suited to resisting attack, this inner wall had been more recently furnished with long casement windows that let in what daylight there was. As I entered, my attention was drawn at once by an enormous metal cage, cleverly engineered to fit the curve of the wall from floor to ceiling, filled with dozens of tiny birds, finches, buntings, tits, and several kinds of warblers. Drawing near, my eye was filled with plump, smooth bodies and bead-bright eyes set like jewels in a background of velvet green, darting among the leaves of oak, elm and chestnut, carefully tended trees rooted in mulched pots set on the floor of the cage. The cheerful racket of conversing birds was punctuated by the whirr of wings and rustle of leaves as the inhabitants flitted and hopped about their business.
"Busy wee things, are they no?"
A deep, pleasant voice spoke from behind me, and I turned with a smile that froze on my face. Colum Mackenzie shared the broad plains and high forehead of his brother Dougal, though the vital force that gave Dougal an air of intimidation was here mellowed into something more welcoming, though no less vibrant. Darker, with dove-grey rather than hazel eyes, Colum gave that same impression of intensity, of standing just slightly closer to you than was quite comfortable. At the moment, though, my discomfort arose from the fact that the beautifully modelled head and long torso ended in shockingly bowed and stumpy legs. The man who should have topped 6 feet came barely to my shoulder. He kept his eyes on the birds, tactfully allowing me a much-needed moment to gain control of my features. Of course he must be used to the reactions of people meeting him for the first time. It occurred to me, glancing around the room, to wonder how often he did meet new people. This was clearly a sanctuary, the self-constructed world of a man to whom the outer world was unwelcome or unavailable.
"I welcome you, mistress," he said with a slight bow. "My name is Colum Ban Campbell Mackenzie, laird of this castle. I understand from my brother that he, encountered you some distance from here."
"He kidnapped me, if you want to know," I said. I would have liked to keep the conversation cordial, but I wanted even more to get away from this castle and back to the hill with the standing stone circle. Whatever had happened to me, the answer lay there, if anywhere. The laird's thick brows rose slightly, and a smile curved the fine-cut lips.
"Well, perhaps," he agreed. "Dougal is sometimes a wee bit impetuous."
"Well," I waved a hand, indicating gracious dismissal of the matter. "I'm prepared to admit that a misunderstanding might have arisen, but I would greatly appreciate being returned to the place he took me from."
"Hmm?"
Brows still raised, Colum gestured toward a chair. I sat reluctantly, and he nodded toward one of the attendants who vanished through the door.
I've sent for some refreshment, Mistress Bouchon, was it? I understand that my brother and his men found ye in, some apparent distress.
He seemed to be hiding a smile, and I wondered just how my supposed state of undress had been described to him.
I took a deep breath. Now it was time for the explanation I had devised. Thinking this out, I had recalled Frank's telling me, during his officer's training, about a course he had taken in withstanding interrogation. The basic principle, insofar as I remembered it, was to stick to the truth as much as humanly possible, altering only those details that must be kept secret. Less chance, the instructor explained, of slipping up in the minor aspects of one's cover story.
Well, we'd have to see how effective that was. Well, yes, I had been attacked, you see.
He nodded, face alight with interest. I? Attacked by whom?
Tell the truth.
By English soldiers. In particular, by a man named Randall.
The patrician face changed suddenly at the name. Though Colum continued to look interested, there was an increased intensity in the line of the mouth and a deepening of the creases that bracketed it. Clearly, that name was familiar.
The Mackenzie chief sat back a bit and steepled his fingers, regarding me carefully over them.
Ah, he said. Tell me more.
So, God help me, I told him more. I gave him in great detail the story of the confrontation between the Scots and Randall's men, since he would be able to check that with Dougal. I told him the basic facts of my conversation with Randall, since I didn't know how much the man Murtagh had overheard. He nodded absorbedly, paying close attention.
Aye, he said. But how did you come to be there in that spot? It's far off the road to Inverness. You meant to take a ship from there, I suppose.
I nodded and took a deep breath. Now we entered, perforce, the realm of invention. I wished I'd paid closer attention to Frank's remarks on the subject of highwaymen, but I would have to do my best. I was a widowed lady of Oxfordshire, I replied. True, so far as it went. Travelling with a manservant en route to distant relatives in France. That seemed safely remote. We had been set upon by highwaymen, and my servant had either been killed or run off. I had myself dashed into the wood on my horse, but had been caught some distance from the road. While I had succeeded in escaping from the bandits, I had perforce to abandon my horse and all property thereon. And while wandering in the woods, I had run afoul of Captain Randall and his men. I sat back a little, pleased with the story. Simple, neat, true, in all checkable details. Colum's face expressed no more than a polite attention. He was opening his mouth to ask me a question when there was a faint rustle at the doorway. A man, one of those I had noticed in the courtyard when we arrived, stood there, holding a small leather box in one hand. The chief of Clan Mackenzie excused himself gracefully and left me studying the birds, with the assurance that he would shortly return to continue our most interesting conversation. No sooner had the door swung shut behind him than I was at the bookshelf, running my hand along the leather bindings. There were perhaps 24 books on this shelf, more on the opposite wall. Hurriedly, I flipped the opening pages of each volume. Several had no publication dates. Those that did were all dated from 1720 to 1742. Colum Mackenzie obviously liked luxury, but the rest of his room gave no particular indication that he was an antiquarian. The bindings were new, with no sign of cracking or foxed pages within. Quite beyond ordinary scruples by this time, I shamelessly rifled the olive wood desk, keeping an ear out for returning footsteps. I found what I supposed I'd been looking for in the central drawer. A half-finished letter, written in a flowing hand, rendered no more legible by the eccentric spelling and total lack of punctuation. The paper was fresh and clean, and the ink crisply black. Legible or not, the date at the top of the page sprang out at me as though written in letters of fire. 20 April, 1743.
When he returned a few moments later, Colum found his guest seated by the casement windows, hands clasped decorously in her lap. Seated, because my legs would no longer hold me up. Hands clasped to hide the trembling that had made it difficult for me to stuff the letter back into its resting place. He had brought with him the tray of refreshments, mugs of ale and fresh oatcake spread with honey. I nibbled sparingly at these. My stomach was churning too vigorously to allow for any appetite. After a brief apology for his absence, he commiserated with me on my sad misfortune. Then he leaned back, eyed me speculatively, and asked,
"But how is it, Mistress Beauchamp, that my brother's men found you wandering about in your shift? Highwaymen would be reluctant to molest your person, as they'd likely mean to hold you for ransom. And even with such things as I've heard of Captain Randall, I'd be surprised to hear that an officer in the English army was in the habit of raping stray travellers."
"Oh," I snapped. "Well, whatever you've heard about him, I assure you he's entirely capable of it." I had overlooked the detail of my clothing when planning my story, and wondered at what point in our encounter the man Murta had spotted the captain and myself.
"Ah, oh, well," said Colum. "Possible, I dare say. The man's a bad reputation, to be sure."
"Possible," I said. "Why? Don't you believe what I've told you?" For the Mackenzie chieftain's face was showing a faint but definite scepticism.
"I did not say I didn't believe you, mistress," he answered evenly. "But I've not held the leadership of a large clan for 20-odd years without learning not to swallow whole every tale I'm told."
"Well, if you don't believe I am who I say, who in bloody hell do you think I am?" I demanded. He blinked, taken aback by my language. Then the sharp-cut features firmed again.
"That," he said, "remains to be seen. In the meantime, mistress, you're a welcome guest at Leoch."
He raised a hand in gracious dismissal, and the ever-present attendant near the door came forward, obviously to escort me back to my quarters. Colum didn't say the next words, but he might as well have. They hung in the air behind me as clearly as though spoken as I walked away.
"Until I find out who you really are."
Part 2. Castle Leoch. Chapter 6. Colum's Hall. The small boy Mrs. Fitzgibbons had referred to as young Alec came to fetch me to dinner. This was held in a long, narrow room outfitted with tables down the length of each wall, supplied by a constant stream of servants issuing from archways at either end of the room, laden with trays, trenchers, and jugs. The rays of early summer's late sunlight came through the high, narrow windows. Sconces along the walls below held torches to be lighted as the daylight failed. Banners and tartans hung on the walls between the windows, plaids and heraldry of all descriptions splotching the stones with colour. By contrast, most of the people gathered below for dinner were dressed in serviceable shades of grey and brown, or in the soft brown and green plaid of hunting kilts, muted tones suited for hiding in the heather. I could feel curious glances boring into my back as young Alec led me toward the top of the room, but most of the diners kept their eyes politely upon their plates. There seemed little ceremony here. People ate as they pleased, helping themselves from the serving platters, or taking their wooden plates to the far end of the room, where two young boys turned a sheep's carcass on a spit in the enormous fireplace. There were some 40 people set to eat, and perhaps another 10 to serve. The air was loud with conversation, most of it in Gaelic. Colum was already seated at a table at the head of the room, stunted legs tucked out of sight beneath the scarred oak. He nodded graciously at my appearance, and waved me to a seat on his left, next to a plump and pretty red-haired woman he introduced as his wife, Letitia.
"And this is my son, Hamish," he said,
dropping a hand on the shoulder of a handsome red-haired lad of 7 or 8, who took his eye off the waiting platter just long enough to acknowledge my presence with a quick nod. I looked at the boy with interest. He looked like all the other Mackenzie males I had seen, with the same broad, flat cheekbones and deep-set eyes. In fact, allowing for the difference in colouring, he might be a smaller version of his uncle Dougal, who sat next to him. The two teenage girls next to Dougal, who giggled and poked each other when introduced to me, were his daughters, Margaret and Eleanor. Dougal gave me a brief but friendly smile before snatching the platter out from under the reaching spoon of one of his daughters and shoving it toward me.
"Are you no manners, lass?" he scolded. "Guests first."
I rather hesitantly picked up the large horn spoon offered me. I hadn't been sure what sort of food was likely to be offered, and was somewhat relieved to find that this platter held a row of homely and completely familiar smoked herring. I'd never tried to eat a herring with a spoon, but I saw nothing resembling a fork, and dimly recalled that runcible spoons wouldn't be in general use for quite a few years yet. Judging from the behaviour of eaters at other tables, when a spoon proved impracticable, the ever-handy dirk was employed for the slicing of meat and removal of bones. Lacking a dirk, I resolved to chew cautiously and lean forward to scoop up a herring, only to find the deep blue eyes of young Hamish fixed accusingly on me. "You've no said grace yet," he said severely, small face screwed into a frown. Obviously, he considered me a conscienceless heathen, if not downright depraved.
Perhaps you would be so kind as to say it for me," I ventured.
The cornflower eyes popped open in surprise, but after a moment's consideration, he nodded and folded his hands in a businesslike fashion. He glared round the table to ensure that everyone was in a properly reverential attitude before bowing his own head. "Satisfied?" he intoned. "Some he meat that canna eat, and some could eat that want it. We he meat, and we can eat, and so may God be thankit. Amen." Looking up from my respectfully folded hands, I caught Colum's eye, and gave him a smile that acknowledged the sang-froid of his offspring. He suppressed his own smile and nodded gravely at his son.
"Nicely said, lad. Will you hand round the bread?"
Conversation at table was limited to occasional requests for further food, as everyone settled down to serious eating. I found my own appetite rather lacking, partly owing to the shock of my circumstances, and partly to the fact that I really didn't care for herring when all was said and done. The mutton was quite good, though, and the bread was delicious, fresh and crusty, with large dollops of fresh unsalted butter. "I hope Mr. McTavish is feeling better," I offered, during a momentary pause for breath. "I didn't see him when I came in." "McTavish?" Letitia's delicate brows tilted over round blue eyes. I felt, rather than saw, Dougal look up beside me.
"Young Jamie,"
he said briefly, before returning his attention to the mutton bone in his hands.
"Jamie? Why, whatever's the matter with the lad?"
Her full-cheeked countenance creased with concern.
"Naught but a scratch, my dear," Colum soothed.
He glanced across at his brother.
"Where is he, though, Dougal?"
I imagined, perhaps, that the dark eyes held a hint of suspicion. His brother shrugged, eyes still on his plate.
"I sent him down to the stables to help old Alec wee the horses. Seemed the best place for him, all things considered."
He raised his eyes to meet his brother's gaze.
"Or did you have some other idea?"
Colum seemed dubious.
"The stables?" "Aye, well. You trust him so far?"
Dougal wiped a hand carelessly across his mouth and reached for a loaf of bread.
"It's yours to say, Colum, if you didn't agree with my orders."
Colum's lips tightened briefly, but he only said,
"Nay. I reckon he'll do well enough there,"
before returning to his meal. I had some doubts myself as to a stable being the proper place for a patient with a gunshot wound, but was reluctant to offer an opinion in this company. I resolved to seek out the young man in question in the morning, just to assure myself that he was as suitably cared for as could be managed. I refused the pudding and excused myself, pleading tiredness, which was in no way prevarication. I was so exhausted that I scarcely paid attention when Colum said,
Good night to you then, Mistress Beecham. I'll send someone to bring you to Hall in the morning.
One of the servants, seeing me groping my way along the corridor, kindly lighted me to my chamber. She touched her candle to the one on my table, and a mellow light flickered over the massive stones of the wall, giving me a moment's feeling of entombment. Once she had left, though, I pulled the embroidered hanging away from the window, and the feeling blew away with the inrush of cool air. I tried to think about everything that had happened, but my mind refused to consider anything but sleep. I slid under the quilts, blew out the candle, and fell asleep, watching the slow rise of the moon. It was the massive Mrs. Fitzgibbons who arrived again to wake me in the morning, bearing what appeared to be the full array of toiletries available to a well-born Scottish lady. Lead combs to darken the eyebrows and lashes, pots of powdered orris root and rice powder, even a stick of what I assumed was coal, though I'd never seen any, and a delicate lidded porcelain cup of French rouge, incised with a row of gilded swans. Mrs. Fitzgibbons also had a striped green overskirt and bodice of silk with yellow lisle stockings, as a change from the homespun I'd been provided with the day before. Whatever Hall involved, it seemed to be an occasion of some consequence. I was tempted to insist on attending in my own clothes, just to be contrary, but the memory of Fat Rupert's response to my shift was sufficient to deter me. Besides, I rather liked Colum, despite the fact that he apparently intended to keep me here for the foreseeable future. "Well, we just see about that," I thought, as I did my best with the rouge. Dougal had said the young man I had doctored was in the stables, hadn't he? And the stables presumably had horses, upon which one could ride away. I resolved to go looking for Jamie McTavish as soon as Hall was over with. Hall turned out to be just that, the dining hall, where I had eaten the night before. Now it was transformed, though. Tables, benches, and stools pushed back against the walls, the head table removed and replaced by a substantial carved chair of dark wood, covered with what I assumed must be the Mackenzie tartan, a plaid of dark green and black, with a faint red and white overcheck. Sprigs of holly decorated the walls, and there were fresh rushes strewn on the stone flags. A young piper was blowing up a set of small pipes behind the empty chair with numerous sighs and wheezes. Near him were what I assumed must be the intimate members of Colum's staff, a thin-faced man in trews and smocked shirt, who lounged against the wall, a bawling little man in a coat of fine brocade, clearly a scribe of some sort, as he was seated at a small table equipped with inkhorn, quills, and paper. Two brawny, kilted men with the attitude of guards, and to one side, one of the largest men I have ever seen. I stared at this giant with some awe. Coarse black hair grew far down on his forehead, nearly meeting the beetling eyebrows. Similar mats covered the immense forearms, exposed by the rolled-up sleeves of his shirt. Unlike most of the men I had seen, the giant didn't seem to be armed, save for a tiny knife he carried in his stocking top. I could barely make out the stubby hilt in the thickets of black curls that covered his legs above the gaily checked hose. A broad leather belt circled what must be a 40-inch waist, but carried neither dirk nor sword. In spite of his size, the man had an amiable expression, and seemed to be joking with the thin-faced man, who looked like a marionette in comparison with his huge conversant. The piper suddenly began to play with a preliminary belch, followed at once by an ear-splitting screech that eventually settled down into something resembling a tune. There were some 30 or 40 people present, all seeming somewhat better dressed and groomed than the diners of the night before. All heads turned to the lower end of the hall where, after a pause for the music to build up steam, Colum entered, followed at a few paces by his brother Dougal. Both Mackenzies were clearly dressed for ceremony in dark green kilts and well-cut coats. Colum's of pale green and Dougal's of russet, both with the plaid slung across their chests and secured at one shoulder by a large jewelled brooch. Colum's black hair was loose today, carefully oiled and curled upon his shoulders. Dougal's was still clubbed back in a queue that nearly matched the russet satin of his coat. Colum